Welcome to Audio Notes. I'm David Finkel, Artistic Director of Music at Menlo, and it is my great pleasure to welcome you to the festival's 2013 season, From Bach. This season, Music at Menlo celebrates Johann Sebastian Bach, the composer universally recognized as the greatest in Western music history. To the ears of many modern listeners, the canon begins with Bach, and in the 2.5 centuries since Bach's death, arguably every major musical innovation has borne his influence. Bach's legacy endures, whether in the craftsmanship of composers from Haydn to Mozart to Mendelssohn, in the sonic magnitude of Brahms, Bartok, and Shostakovich, and even in the sensual allure of Debussy, Richard Strauss, and George Gershwin. Audio Notes are designed to enhance your enjoyment and deepen your appreciation of the music you'll be hearing at the festival. I'll be joined by Artistic Co-Director Wu Han, Music at Menlo's Artistic Administrator Patrick Castillo, and some of this season's festival artists to offer historical and cultural context and a variety of perspectives on this summer's concert programs. Thank you for listening, and we look forward to seeing you at the concerts.
Like the string quartet, the piano trio is a distinct musical tradition that came into its own only after Bach's time. Nevertheless, like the entire literature, the piano trio repertoire remains indebted to Bach's art. His sonatas for violin and keyboard, typically performed with cello augmenting the continuo, and which C.P.E. Bach referred to as harpsichord trios, set a model for keyboard and strings writing that Mozart and Brahms would affirm in subsequent generations. A hallowed tradition beautifully disintegrates in cafe music, Paul Schoenfeld's crack at a kind of high-class dinner music, drawing equally on Bach, Brahms, and Broadway. Concert Program 5, Trio Transformations, begins with Bach's Sonata for Violin and Keyboard in C minor, BWV 1017.
Bach composed his 6 sonatas for violin and harpsichord around the years 1720 to 1725. The earliest existing version of the set identifies them as 6 sonatas for obbligato harpsichord and solo violin, with a bass accompanied by a viola da gamba, if you like. Okay, this bears some explanation. Typically, in the Baroque period, such sonatas would be composed for violin and continuo, in which the keyboardist would be given a figured bass rather than a fully written part. A figured bass part gives the player just a bass line furnished with figures and other symbols, indicating the harmonies to be realized. The realization is up to the player's technique and invites some degree of improvisation. In these sonatas, Bach writes a harpsichord obbligato part, in which everything is fully worked out, including melodic lines that are assigned to the keyboardist's right hand. The left hand, Bach allows to be augmented by a different sonority, the viola da gamba, a precursor to the modern cello. The point of all this is that Bach conceived of these sonatas, musically, as a conversation between 3 distinct voices, the violin, the right hand of the harpsichord, and the bass. With this in mind, we can better understand these sonatas, not as forebears to the violin sonatas of later periods, but to the piano trio literature. The violinist and Baroque expert Andrew Manzi has observed, quote, "So skillfully does Bach handle the 3 elements, testing the relationship between them in every conceivable way, that these pieces might be seen as one of the final and fullest flowerings of the trio sonata form, an apotheosis of the genre," end quote. Bach's son, Carl Philipp Emanuel, concurred with this way of thinking, when writing of these sonatas in 1774, quote, "The 6 harpsichord trios are amongst the finest works of my dearly beloved father," end quote. If Bach's son regarded these works as harpsichord trios, it's certain that Bach himself did as well. The 4th of the violin and keyboard sonatas, or, if you will, keyboard trios, in C minor, BWV 1017, begins with an impassioned Siciliano, a common Baroque form in a slow, lilting 6-8 tempo. Bach immediately establishes the 3-voice texture, with the keyboard providing a steady bass in the left hand and flowing arpeggios in the right beneath the melody in the violin. The Allegro second movement begins with eloquent counterpoint in the keyboard alone. The violin enters soon, picking up the keyboard melody a fifth higher. C.P.E. Bach also wrote of his father's keyboard trios, quote, "There are several adagios in them, which even nowadays could not be set in a more singing style," end quote. The third movement adagio of the C minor trio is a case in point, as the violin offers a deeply felt cantabile melody. The trio concludes with an arresting allegro finale, featuring the work's most intricate three-part counterpoint. The prominent involvement of all three voices affirms the place of these sonatas at the genesis of the piano trio repertoire that would develop over subsequent generations. Just as in Bach we have the apotheosis of the Baroque period, so does the music of Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart represent the finest of the classical era, the period that followed. All of the musical values of that period are given their most perfect voice by Mozart. Viennese classicism valued the primacy of melody. Mozart's melodies are poetic, expressive, uncannily beautiful. His rich harmonies and instrumental textures are equally seductive. And as classicism moved away from the complexity of Bach's fugues towards more transparent forms, the effortlessness of Mozart's music belies its formal sophistication. Establishing himself in Vienna as history's first freelance composer, Mozart played the dual roles of artist and impresario to great success between 1784 and 1786. He frequently presented concerts unveiling his latest compositions, typically a symphony, a chamber work, perhaps a keyboard improvisation, and a piano concerto. By 1786, he was at the height of his celebrity, but in the meantime, his impresario period had nearly run its course. Relying increasingly on publishing fees, Mozart composed at a furious pace. In the latter half of 1786 alone, he completed the E-flat piano quartet, the Kegelstadt trio, the concert aria Ch'io mi scordi di te, the fourth horn concerto, and two piano trios, the G major, K496, and B flat, K502, among numerous other works. The G major trio is the second of Mozart's six works for piano trio. However, following as it does the less substantial B flat divertimento, composed 10 years prior, the G major may be considered Mozart's first mature essay in the piano trio genre. It demonstrates a thoughtful approach to the ensemble of piano, violin, and cello. The part writing is impeccably done, with each instrument asserting a strong individual voice throughout the work's three movements. The first movement allegro begins, somewhat unexpectedly, with 17 bars of solo piano. The theme is florid and eloquently ornamented, yet clear and direct as per the classical style. The piano and violin join forces to state the second theme. The ensemble texture remains limpid as the piano comes to the fore with a new melodic idea. The development section features more unfettered part writing. After a forceful unison statement of a fragment of the main theme, the cello enters into a thoughtful dialogue with the piano's left hand. The balance of this dialogue shifts upwards, with the violin and piano right hand continuing the exchange of thematic fragments. A momentary hesitation in the piano, answered by another forceful unison, leads nonchalantly to the recapitulation. The second movement is a beguiling andante. As with the first movement, the conversational quality of Mozart's part writing lends this unpretentious andante its particular charm. Mozart's harmonic inventiveness is also on display. To take just one example, when the music modulates from C major to the dominant key of G, as would be expected, it alights temporarily in the remote key of A flat major, as if taking an unexpectedly scenic route to its eventual destination. Listen, and even if you don't follow the harmonic analysis, just listen for the moments when the music takes a curious turn. It's like a light coming on to reveal more of the scene than we were previously aware of. The music is full of exquisite moments like that, yet its simplicity of character is never compromised. This element of creative invention that somehow never obfuscates a certain obviousness, a feeling of inevitability, is one of the miracles of Mozart's artistry. The trio concludes with a variations movement based on a happy-go-lucky tune. Six variations follow. None of the variations radically transfigures the theme. Instead, each subtly views the melody from a slightly different perspective, as if turning a precious stone to examine it from different angles and in different light. The third variation contains the finale's most animated music. The introspective fourth variation responds in a slower tempo and in a minor key. The fifth variation, back in the home key of G major, presents a thoughtful rumination on the theme. But the air of the movement's opening measures returns for the final variation, bringing the trio to a carefree close. Johannes Brahms composed the third of his three piano trios, the trio in C minor, opus 101, in 1886. By this time, at age 53, Brahms held status as Europe's most celebrated composer, and was highly sought after as a concert pianist to boot. But as his stature continued to grow, Brahms turned increasingly inward, living simply and frugally, a confirmed bachelor and monastic intellectual. The C minor piano trio, composed during an extended summer trip to Switzerland, reflects Brahms's introspection during this period. It's a terse and compact work, the shortest of Brahms's trios, but no less rich in substance than its elder siblings. And in its structure, too, the trio demonstrates the distillation of Brahms's compositional ideas to their pithiest form. The music that begins the trio is stern and direct. Brahms was a master at taking the shortest, simplest musical idea and using it as the germinal cell for a large-scale work, much like his hero, Beethoven, famously accomplished in his path-breaking Fifth Symphony, using a four-note motif as the building block for the entire work. To a less obvious but equally inventive degree, Brahms here takes an ascending stepwise three-note phrase, which appears in the piano in the trio's first two measures. And constructs not just this first movement, but indeed much of the entire trio from this motif. Listen again to the opening, and notice how that three-note gesture's propulsive sweep drives the music forward. The lyrical second theme marks a change in character, but still derives from that three-note motto. Now made legato, and extended into a broad lyrical melody. Throughout the remainder of the movement, Brahms continues to develop the simplest of musical ideas, tirelessly exploring its expressive potential. The obituary of another of Brahms's most significant influences, J.S. Bach, claims that Bach, quote, had only to hear any main theme to have in mind, as if instantaneously, almost everything artful that could be done with it, end quote. In listening to this trio, the same could be said of Brahms's obsessive pursuit of his three-note motif's every possible implication. The melody that begins the second movement starts with a rhythmically altered version of the three-note motif and veers upwards and downwards. Spinning a reserved but eloquent melody. The violin and cello play concertino with muted strings, enhancing the melody's mysterious character. The third movement, marked Andante Grazioso, presents a spacious theme, also derived from the trio's central three-note motif. But in this iteration, rather than ascending stepwise, the motif encompasses a broader range. Brahms's management of different sonorities at the start of this movement is simple yet striking. He begins with the violin and cello, rhythmically active, but sounding spare without the piano. Then follows with the piano alone, unshaded by the string timbres. The melody is so pure and unassuming, you might not even have noticed its unusual meter. Rather than a standard 3-beat or 4-beat meter, Brahms writes the melody in 7-beat phrases, alternating single 3-4 measures with pairs of 2-4 measures. A more animated middle section inverts the three-note motif, this time descending by step. Brahms casts the melody in another asymmetrical meter, combining 9-8 and 6-8 time, phrases of 3 beats plus 2 beats. The opening of the finale transfigures the three-note motif in another way. Starting with the cell in its original form, an ascending stepwise motto, Brahms changes the note order and repeats the first note, turning it into a four-note gesture. Then further manipulates the motif to shape a long melodic contour. While that's unfolding, listen too to the left hand of the piano accompaniment, which accentuates the music's rhythmic profile with three-note fragments of its own. Brahms introduces a new theme, beginning now with a descending three-note figure. Listen for how expertly Brahms once again extrapolates from this simple gesture such a rich melodic idea. This finale, in fact, the whole trio, but the finale in particular, amply demonstrates Brahms' mastery of a technique called developing variation, a term coined a generation later by the composer Arnold Schoenberg to describe a particular method of thematic development found especially in Brahms' music. Schoenberg described the technique as, quote, variation of the features of a basic unit, producing all the thematic formulations which provide for fluency, contrasts, variety, logic, and unity on the one hand, and character, mood, expression, and every needed differentiation on the other hand, thus elaborating the idea of the piece. End quote. So the basic unit here is the three-note motif, which Brahms spins into the finale's opening theme. And throughout the movement, Brahms varies the features of that basic unit, providing, like Schoenberg points out, contrasts, variety, logic, and unity on the one hand, and character, mood, and expression on the other hand. Here, early on in the movement, is a relatively straightforward variation on that theme. Later, Brahms sets the three-note motif in its descending form in loud chords in the piano, which the strings pepper with the rhythmic fragments that otherwise permeate the finale. The most dramatic transformation comes near the end of the movement. Brahms transmutes the motif's rhythmic profile, distilling the theme into pure melody, and moreover, leaving the home key of C minor for the bucolic C major. But the rhythmic vigor prevails at the trio's conclusion. The program concludes with Paul Schoenfield's Café Music for Piano Trio, composed in 1986. Schoenfield writes the following about Café Music.
The idea to compose Café Music first came to me in 1985, after sitting in one night for the pianist at Murray's Restaurant in Minneapolis. Murray's employs a house trio, which plays entertaining dinner music in a wide variety of styles. My intention was to write a kind of high-class dinner music, music which could be played at a restaurant, but might also, just barely, find its way into a concert hall. The work draws on many of the types of music played by the trio at Murray's. For example, early 20th century American, Viennese, light classical, gypsy, and Broadway styles are all represented.
Given its kaleidoscope of musical idioms, Café Music represents a uniquely delightful contribution to the piano trio literature. A second theme glides from the swinging rhythm of the opening melody to a dance of a slightly different gait. This is just the beginning of the cornucopia of musical idioms that Schoenfield integrates into his trio. The composer goes on to note that, quote, a paraphrase of a beautiful Hasidic melody is incorporated in the second movement, end quote. Schoenfield, who often incorporates Jewish folk elements into his music, dresses this Hasidic paraphrase in jazzy attire. Café Music ends with a high-octane and highly entertaining presto movement. In the span of just the first minute of the finale, we hear shades of Verdi's Requiem, Roadrunner cartoons, gypsy folk music, silent film music, free jazz, and any number of other musical elements that might strike the ear. And consider that this is all raucously given voice by the piano trio, a medium whose lineage begins with Haydn, Mozart, and even further back to the harpsichord trios of Johann Sebastian Bach. Audio Notes are authored and produced by Patrick Castillo and narrated by David Finkel, Patrick Castillo, and Wu Han. Additional narration is provided by Andrew Goldstein. Additional mastering is provided by Dahong Situ. Musical excerpts appear courtesy of the following artists and organizations. J.S. Bach's Sonata for Violin and Harpsichord in C Minor, performed by Elizabeth Walfish and Paul Nicholson. Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart's G Major Piano Trio and Johannes Brahms's C Minor Piano Trio, Opus 101, performed by the Florestan Trio, appear courtesy of Hyperion Records. Paul Schoenfield's Café Music, performed by Lev Poliakin, Charles Bernard, and Francis Renzi, appears courtesy of Innova Records. Bach's Fifth French Suite, performed by Wilhelm Kempf, appears courtesy of Deutsche Grammophon. Camille Saint-Saëns' Fantasy, performed by the Banff Camerata, appears courtesy of Summit Records Incorporated. Claude Debussy's Sonata for Flute, Viola, and Harp, performed by Ransom Wilson, Paul Neubauer, and Heidi Leyvalder, and César Franck's Piano Quintet, performed by Angela Hewitt, Annika Vafian, Jennifer Frauci, Paul Neubauer, and Daniel Mueller-Schott, appear courtesy of the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln Center. Marcel Tournier's Opus 34 Suite is performed by the Linos Harfen Quintet and appears courtesy of Hensler Classic. Audio Notes is a copyrighted production of Artist Led.